podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 47 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? Today I'm talking to Hugh Todd, who's a good friend of mine. And as we say right at the end of our chat, we kind of got into the business a similar kind of time. What I thought was very interesting about chatting to him is his path ended up being very different to mine. I mean, similar, but different. I mean, working in good big agencies in London and producing some award-winning work, more award-winning work than I produced, because he's probably a bit better than me. But, you know, that aside, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff here, not just for people of our collective age, but, you know, the path that you go on. Because with Hugh, we're kind of getting an entire career of moving around agencies, winning awards here and there, working with really fantastic people like Dave Droger and Russell Ramsey and John Hegarty and people like that. So there's a lot to learn there, and there's also, you know, a lot to learn as to what happens as that career goes on. I think it's a perennial question with a lot of the people that I talk to, because you get in, it's all exciting, it's all new, it's all different. You kind of become more established and you reach a bit of a plateau, but it's probably still exciting and different and interesting. And then I think you've got to make a decision about what to do next. And, you know, as we chat a little bit, you know, Ben Priest went through this as well. How do you probably change from being a partnership? Maybe the next people I should talk to should be a team that are stuck together for a very long time. But, you know, for most people, there's a point where you're not going to be hired as a team anymore. You're going to be a single person as a CD on a piece of business, or a CD of an entire agency, almost always solo, because I guess people don't want to pay two salaries to do that. And do you necessarily need two people? But it's really great chatting to Hugh and talking about, you know, a lot of the interesting things that have gone on in the business since the mid-90s. And how that's changed and how he's adapted and how the industry's adapted as well. So sit back, light up a pipe, pour yourself a brandy. I don't know what you guys do when you listen to this. Probably get on the number 11 and have a little listen. And at this point you're going, shut up, Ben, I want to listen to Hugh. So with that in mind, here is our chat.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for making the time to chat here. It's very kind of you.
Pleasure,
great. Okay, well, if memory serves, I think either we could start your story at Watford, because I think you went to Watford, but why did you go to Watford would be another question.
Oh, my God, we're going that far back. Watford, yeah, that was a turning point in my life, because I'd already done a degree at Manchester University in some God-forbidden subject. I think it was like construction surveying or something. It was really, really boring. But I had a lot of fun doing it. But I knew it wasn't my passion in life. So I travelled around America for a year, just dossing around. And I came home and went on a dole in Manchester and tried to find myself again. That involved a little bit of writing, actually, for the magazine up there and a few things. And I started thinking, yeah, I actually really like doing this. And so I did a bit of that. And then I don't know how, but I found out about a thing called copywriting, which sounded really good, because it was like a bit of not too heavy on the journalism side, because I'm a bit thick like that. And it allowed you to have a bit more fun with sort of ideas. So heard about Watford, and I suppose I applied for Watford, yeah.
How did you hear about Watford? Because I think people must have lots of weird stories about this, because I went and did like some work experience at a small agency off Soho Square, and they told me about Watford, and also my mum went there. But how did you find out about it?
That's really funny, isn't it, how we all ended up in this random place with Tony. God, do you know what? That's a really good question. I think I was in a library in Manchester, again, just sort of not sure what I was up to. And library, there you go. That takes it. Shows how long ago it was. And I think there was either a little pamphlet about copywriting, or there might have been Alistair Crompton's brilliant book about the craft of copywriting, which I got out. Yeah, and then it just sort of, the minute I kind of found out about it, I thought, this is it. This is what I want to do.
Well, that's cool. So which year were you in Watford?
So we were in the guinea pig year for Tony Cunningham. So Tony, I think it was his first full year. And, God, it was really hard. I don't know about you, but it was really hard to get in. It was like there was this the sort of copywriting test, which I thought I did. I thought, well, that was good, and I enjoyed that. And then he got me in for an interview like everyone else. And I wore a suit, like a knob, basically. And it was really embarrassing. And Tony was quite hard on me, and he sort of – he really called me out on a few things. And I thought, God, I've really screwed that up. I'm not going to get in. And I did. And I think it was good because actually he really sort of prodded me in the interview and said, oh, well, you don't know what you want to do and this, that, and the other. And I said, no, I really made a kind of bit of a heartened speech. And I got in, and I think it was, it was a really good moment for me because I was really, if I didn't get in there, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And it kind of definitely, my father was going a bit bonkers because he'd run out of money to give me to keep me going. And so, yeah, it was great. And we went down there. And honestly, I think that is, you know, one of those sort of moments we tell your kids about and you go, that was when it changed for me. And it was a great year. There was a whole bunch of random people. There was a guy who's turned out to be a great mate who was an estate agent for 5 years. There was a guy who was an account man who's now a brilliant creative. There's Danny Brooke Taylor, of course, the legendary Danny, and there's of course Adam, my partner, I ended up with. So it was a real mixture, like I'm sure your year was as well. And I think Tony handled us pretty well.
I really want to interview Tony at some point. I started talking to him about it and we never quite got around to it, but I will because I think he's the source of many great creatives, obviously, and interesting.
Yeah, you've got to do that. I heard your thing with Caroline. Well, I heard many of your brilliant podcasts, mate. They're absolutely great. And I think you touched upon it with Caroline. You should definitely do a Watford podcast or a Tony one because it's a whole little chapter in itself.
Yeah, I'll get in touch with him. So you met Adam on that course. Were there other suitors who you were gonna go off with?
Yeah, I did. Well, weirdly, I didn't. I actually hung out with Adam. I drank a huge amount of beer with him and had a lot of fun. I never worked with him. I worked with Danny a bit. I worked with a guy called Johnny Benton Hughes, who's my mad friend now, who does lots of different things. He worked in advertising for a bit. Andy Howarth. It was one of those kind of sleeping around thing. You know, you kind of trying a few people out, but I never really clicked with anyone. And actually, by the end of the course, I don't know if you noticed, but I didn't go into for advertising. I went actually into journalism for a while.
No, I didn't know that. So what happened there?
Yeah, so I finished the course and I had some terrible breakup with some, the truth is I had a terrible breakup with some girl from Manchester, and it was a real sort of a toughie, and I ended up saying, right, I got to leave the course, I got to get away from Watford even, I got to get into London and just get away from everything. So I liked doing a bit of journalism before. I liked the kind of longer writing and the sort of seeing your byline a bit. So I, when everyone else went off to do their placements in London and you know, get their heads down at Trots and places like that, I went up at a place called the Soho Runner, which was like a kind of a little rag in Soho, which was, you know, like kind of, it's like a sort of small campaign. It was used to sort of do stuff on the advertising and production world. So I quite enjoyed that. And then when I was there, I kind of got loftier ambitions, and I wrote for Campaign and Creative Review. And I thought, well, this is good, you know, and I even got something in FHM, which was actually called For Him magazine. It shows how long ago it was.
Oh, yeah.
So it was kind of good. But, you know, Ben, I got that bit where it didn't make much money. It took a long time to sort of do stuff. And then all the time I sort of saw my mates who seemed to be having a better time at agencies. And then I thought, you know what? I should get back in. I should go and do it. But I never really even gave it a go. And that's when I kind of, I sort of suddenly thought, well, maybe the journalism thing is nice for the ego and stuff a bit, seeing your name. But it didn't excite me as much as advertising.
And so did you get in touch with Adam again at that point?
Because I used to go out drinking with Adam a lot. And again, still sort of having fun. And I used to see all the teams who were at Watford and we just chat on. And I kind of got into a bit of a rhythm. I had a girlfriend in London and I had a sort of a little flat. And I kind of got into that thing now. I sort of, you know, I was quite happy, but I wasn't mega impressed with my sort of job. And I thought, well, what happened with that Watford thing, you know? And then one night, Adam and I were chatting, and we said, why don't we just get together as a team and really go for it? Because I think he wasn't doing great. He was at a little agency in town somewhere. It was a kind of J. Pond Jones, Gray. He was affiliated to, he did a few stints at places, but didn't seem really happy and didn't have a proper writer. And then I said, yeah, okay, let's go for it. So then began the kind of what I called the trudging around Soho for 2 years, part of my life, which really was, yeah, that was like, I sort of went back to basics, and we created our portfolio right from start. And yeah, it's quite humbling actually, because I'd sort of got used to earning money, and I actually kept a job. But by this point, I was, Christ, I can't believe I did this actually. I was writing long copy for a financial agency somewhere in the city, which paid me well, but it was abysmal creatively. But I just thought, I just wanted the money. And then, so I'd do that in the daytime, and I'd meet Adam in the evening at the Crown and Two Chairmen in town, and we would just start writing ads from like 6 o'clock at the bar. And yeah, it was kind of mad, really. We just did that for, oh God, for ages. You know, we just kept going. We saw some amazing people. And actually, looking back now, I was thinking about it today, that we saw some really brilliant people, and they kind of shaped us and our sort of belief system a bit, which, and without ever actually working in their agency. So, I mean, I'm sure you know Tom or Walt, you know, you were there and those guys were there, and they were one of the biggest, if not the biggest influence on us. So we saw them a lot. We saw Trev and Al a lot at Hal Henry. There was Kate and Tim, Kate Stanners and Tim Hearn, who were ace to us. Trevor Beatty saw us. So we sort of had this kind of set of people we would consistently go to, and we got this book to a really great point, and we thought, this is it, we're going to get a job. And we just couldn't get a job anywhere. And so we were sort of panicking a bit, because it had been like 18 months, 2 years, and, you know, we're just thinking, we need to sort this out soon, or so we're going to just be resigning ourselves to our slightly rubbish other jobs. So Tom and Walter said, Riley, you need to make one of these campaigns in your book, which was for Harley Davidson. And we just didn't understand what they meant. And they were saying, make it, just go and make it. And you know what Tom and Walter like? They were just, they're incredible. They're going, just go and make it. And we said, well, how are we going to do that? And they said, well, go and find a dealer who put his name to it, and we'll try and help you get it produced. And I think at that point, they had ambitions of directing. I think they were actually thinking about using it as a kind of start point to direct. But it never, it didn't transpire like that. And it's a day to Vito Hockney and partners. And through a sort of series of events, that him being with an agency, Tom and Walt having a bit of creative clout, Stark Films made the commercials with the directing duo, Joe Public. And it was amazing, because then we had, not only do we have our portfolio, we had actually a proper campaign of ads, which were run at the cinema, and then it was winning awards and causing all sorts of controversy. We still didn't have a job, and it was, we were nearly at the end of our tether. But then thankfully, Steve Hooper at BBH was a massive, he was really into Harley Davidson's, he had one. And I think he was judging British TV and all gave it a gold, and then said, tried to find us and said, look, you know, that really resonated with me. And they got us in, and then we got our job at BBH. So, you know, it was like 2 year slog, but we finally got in somewhere else, and we were just so relieved.
And they gave you a job straight off? They didn't ask you to do placement, or how did that work?
Yeah, that was awkward, because it was kind of a little bit of a bit of bartering going on there, because we'd done so many placements, and we had this sort of work on our reel, and we'd I thought this was going to happen every year. I thought we were going to write an amazing campaign, get DNAD nominations, win gold awards, and I was, it was so naive. It took us another 7 years, I think, to even get close to being in the book. But we kind of, so we had this sort of slightly, had a bit of attitude, I think, which might have helped us, because I think at one point it was discussed whether we'd have a placement or a job, but we did get a job. And I think Steve and Dan took a bit of a punt on us, and they had to sort of justify our stagacy, which was very, very nice of them. So we did actually get in with a job.
All right. And I actually, that's the first time we met, because I don't know if you remember this, but you came, we all watched England v Holland in Euro 96 in a bar in Camden High School. Right. And for some reason, you and Adam both thought, because I had quite long hair at that stage, you thought I looked Steve McManaman.
Yeah.
And then my partner and I, we came into BBH for a crit. I can't remember who with. And I heard someone shout, yeah, McManaman, from across the creative department. And that was you. It might have been Adam. I think it was you. But I remember that being sorry, really fun. Mate. That was the first time I met you.
Fuck yeah. God, that's such a great moment. I probably me be shouting McManaman at Adam would have probably. So I hope I was polite to you. I do remember that time, actually. That was a brilliant time. So we're going
to
get off advertising a bit for a minute, because there was a sort of gang of people. O'Keefe, Steve Hudson, there's a whole load of them at BBH who were going to all the games, actually getting tickets. And Adam went to a few and I kept missing out. And then the semi-final against Germany came up and we all went. And it was just one of those, I think that's, oh, one of the most heartbreaking football moments of my life, because, you know, I wasn't at Italia 90. That was very close. But that semi-final against Germany, we were Gazza's studs away from the fight. Anyway, God, we've got to stop that. I'll end up getting all into it. Well, nice to have met you then.
Yeah, we would go down a bit of a hole, but that was an amazing summer, if anyone wasn't old enough to remember it. But 96, if you were in London in the summer of 96, it was a great time. I remember being aware of you guys like getting the odd, if it wasn't an award, it was like a little like in campaign posters, like here and there. So I was aware of you being an awardy kind of team then. So is there a point where it took off at BBH?
I don't know really. I mean, I was just thinking about, I'm listening to, I can't remember who did it the other day about, I think it might have been Danny or someone else about going in an agency and being humbled. And on our first day, I remember at BBH, we John Pepia, the head of traffic at the time, took us round to meet everybody. And it was just one of those really amazing, scary, exciting moments. It's like, I mean, the Galacticos of BBH. And at the time, it was just phenomenal. There were, I was thinking of it this morning, there was like Tim Riley and Mike Wells, Rosie Arnold, Nick Worthington, John Gorse, Bruce Crouch, Graham Watson, Stephen Vick, John O'Keefe and Russell Ramsey, Simon Robinson, Joe Moore. It was unbelievable. And every one of them had, you know, done something incredible for Levi's or Audi or Boddington's. And Adam and I walked in there, you know, thinking we're quite good and all this. And then you sort of saw these people and thought, Christ, you know, we're going to be up against these guys every day. So it was brilliant, actually, because it was really challenging. You know, every day you'd go, right, I've got to beat these guys. But you certainly, you know, you felt you were put back in your place a little bit. And the first brief we got was from Hegarty gave us a brief for Polaroid. And we thought, oh, this is going to be great. Pepe had said, yeah, Hegarty's going to put you on Polaroid. And we thought, right, yeah, it's going to be a big TV campaign for Stephen Vick stuff they just done. And it was a trade ad in Germany.
Nice.
And that was really humbling. And then the next brief we got was the graduate recruitment brief for suits. So again, it was like, all right, we're at BBH. It's going to be all Levi's. No. So I think they had a very good way of grounding you and bringing you back in. So we did eventually get onto the good briefs, you know, for Lynx and Levi's and Audi and what have you, one-to-one. You know, it was an amazing client list, but they were very good at managing you, a bit of a kind of Ferguson thing. They would keep you grounded. And if you did something really good, your next brief would be really difficult. They wouldn't go, right, you've just done Levi's, right, here you go, here's Lynx or Audi's or Boddington. I remember Mail on Sunday was the really tough one, which everyone just had to do. But and no one ever really did a good one until Tony and Kim came, and then they did an amazing one. So they were very good like that, BBH. But there was so much, there was a lot of opportunity. But I don't think the world fun. I think we had some highlights, but we didn't win that many awards there as we did actually, weirdly, later in our career at JWT. But I suppose the big thing we did at BBH was the FHM work with Gail Porter.
Yeah. So that must have been pretty interesting, because it was picked up everywhere, wasn't it? It was a big famous thing.
Yeah, it was that. And you know that thing at the time, Ben, you just sort of think, we were just sort of doing it and not really thinking much about it. We'd met Dom Jolly, weirdly, from Trigger Happy TV, and he was just sort of getting big. He hadn't done Trigger Happy at the time, but he'd been on the cover of newspapers by dressing up as the devil behind Mandelson. And then he did something to Jeremy Archer. He got dressed up as a gorilla. So we got in, someone got us into him, and it was like, great. So he said, right, what you got to do? He said, it's a bit like a trotty thing. He said, like, you got to think of 10 brilliant things on voting, because we wanted, the issue was vote for your 100 sexiest women. So he had all these ideas, and he said, well, try and do 10, and one will stick, and you won't know which one, but you got to do them all. Because he said he was always doing lots of stupid things, and sometimes the papers would pick it up, and other times it would be a complete waste of time. I mean, it's a bit like that bloke at the Tory conference, I suppose, the other day, giving the P45. You know, that might have got picked up, or might not. He did it to Sepp Blatter, but I think you have to keep going. So we did a few things. We did some fly posters, which were quite funny. They're kind of like voting gags, and they're okay. And then we were going to have women marching on Parliament. We're going to film that, and that sort of went by the wayside. And then we were going to make party political broadcasts by women saying why they should be in office and stuff. And so we did lots of these. And one of them was just a projection onto the Houses of Parliament. And that was just one of like 10 ideas. And it was going to be Caprice, who was big at the time. But then somebody rang up and said, oh, you can't get her. But there's this woman called Gail Porter who wants to shed her cozy image. So, you know, that's it. So they sent us a slide of her. And we Birdie set the type to say, vote Gail, you know, 100 sexist women. And off we went onto the bridge up to the House of Commons with this little projector from Cunning, got to get this right, Cunning Stunts.
Yes.
And we just sat there. And, of course, it's funny, this bit of the story, because when things go wrong, it's a real lesson, and actually it's a silver lining, and actually it was the making of you. So what happened is we got on the thing, and we started projecting, and the projector broke immediately, and you could only have one slide. So you could either have vote Gail, you know, FHM's 100 sexist women, which was sort of crucial to the idea in my mind, and then Gail. But you couldn't, there's no, or Gail, you know, just going up the side of Big Ben, but you couldn't have both. And I was going, oh, God, that's the whole idea. That's like running a press ad with no visual or, you know, and I was getting really annoyed. So we said, well, we'll have to just come back tomorrow. I said, all right, okay, but what are we going to do tonight? So they said, well, we'll just do Gail. Just do Gail at the side of Big Ben, see what happens. And it sort of ended up being the whole making of it, because it was like it had no branding or anything. And so it's sort of weird. It didn't quite explain itself at all. And the police kept coming over the bridge, and they came over once and said, you need to turn it off or we're going to arrest you. And we said, okay. So then they went back, and then we did it again. And they said, right, her nipple, a late night debate. And the light is going so brightly into the room. So we pushed it, and we did it again. And then we had to shut it down, because I think they really were going to do us. So we kind of did it. It was a summer. I remember it was a bit It was about midnight by the time we finished. And I went home thinking, well, that was a bit of a laugh, but we'll do it again tomorrow properly. And then, of course, the next day got up and is on every newspaper, every front page, virtually. All the tabloids had it on the front page. I think the Times even had it on their page 3. And it was just ridiculous. And we'd never, ever imagined a pattern like that at all. And so it was just, like, bizarre. And we'd ended up with this sort of coverage by fluke. You're going to put the word vote Gail and FHM. I think it would have over-explained it, and I think it would have, I don't know, you know, I think it would have just made it more rounded, and people go, oh yeah, I see what they're doing now. I mean, hopefully we would have got coverage, but I don't think it would have been deemed as strange as it was.
And when you went back to the agency, were there people going like, oh, well done, that's amazing, was Heggs like nice stuff?
It was really weird, mate. It was like, because BBH was so, I mean, me and Adam weren't a very BBH team, I remember. Because we used to go and see Trevor Nell a lot and Tom Wood, and we had this sort of, our book was quite gobby, and I don't know, you know, just, and we always thought we were going to end up at Howe Henry, because we had that sort of doing random stuff and not kind of fitting in really. And then when we got into BBH, it was very slick.
Yeah.
And very, and we thought, oh, we might not fit in here. But in a way, Heggs was quite smart. He thought, well, there's room for a pair like them as well, you know. And I think he saw us as those sort of people. So, you know, so I think he was very pleased. I mean, I remember him coming in and saying, good job. But because there was so much success at BBH at the time, you know, they had amazing Levi's ads, you know, like John and Nick had just won like 3 pencils, I think, then Polaroid, Gondry stuff was just cleaning up, and they were, you know, everyone was doing brilliant all the time. So it was another, you know, a really good job. But I think I don't think at the time we realised, and to this day, I sort of always thought Cunning Stunts made more of it than we did, because we just had it as another thing, and they really bigged it up, and fair play to them, they did it with us, but we never really, I don't know, sort of owned it as much as they did. They did a lot on it. But I mean, I think that the thing was that projector only cost like £3,000, and we worked out some like £4 million,
wow,
quid in equivalent media coverage, you know. So it was hilarious that the client loved it, and then they said, because they were against Loaded at the time, and it was that whole Lads Mag,
oh yeah,
time, you know. And Loaded really were the best. They were the forerunner. James Brown had that thing nailed. But you know, FHM, they just kept going, they kind of copied it a bit, and to be fair, they did really well, and that stunt ended up getting them over the million mark, and they wanted to hit a million circulation, and it never went any higher after that. I don't know, it just, maybe that was the high and the low point, you know, it started to tail off. But of course, then every year after that, we'd get the brief and they go, what's your projection idea? And it'd be like, no, you've done that. You have to do something else. And they just started to make it. That's the awful thing. When you go, right, here's a Maverick thing. We're going to, I don't know, make a, get the Grim Reaper walking behind David Moyes at a football match. God, that's brilliant. It's inspired, isn't it? For Paddy Power. But you wouldn't go, right, next year, should we do a ghost behind him or something? Yeah. You know, you go, no, you do something else. And it was weird. FHM, I think the client had changed, because the guy we had was really ambitious and he just was up stuff. And then the next year they said, well, let's just do the same. But I mean, by then it was, you know, we had sort of done it. And I think that became our, whether we liked it, I think we were a bit like, it was a bit strange really, because we'd sort of done it and we wanted them to, you know, like do something else. And I think the client actually changed at that point, because we had a very ambitious client initially who was really up for doing, you know, innovative stuff and, you know, stuff that's going to get on the news. So we did that projection and we thought, right, next year we'll do something crazy. We'll do like women marching on Parliament, or, you know, we'll fake party political broadcasts. Like some of the ideas we hadn't got through, we talked about Dom Jolly about. But they just kept saying, no, just do a projection next year. So we actually don't think we worked on it after that. I think we pulled out. I think there was one... We worked on it one more time, but then the brief got really, everyone was really interested to work on it. I mean, at the time, you know, because Levi, BBH had so many amazing clients, like Levi's, Audi, Bodies, etc. Like I was saying before, FHM was not deemed one of the amazing ones because they just had so many other things. But then I think after the Vogue Gale thing, people start thinking, oh, this is a chance to do some really interesting stuff. And Ed and James came in, I think it was a year or two later, and they did something quite cool on it. And you know, it became a client who were up for kind of guerrilla type advertising, I suppose, which was, you know, cool.
And so as far as your career at BBH was going, how long were you there altogether, and how was that all going?
I think it was 6 years in total. And we loved it. It was amazing. Like, Hegarty was just like, I'm still sort of finding myself quoting him now in various agencies. Just some of the stuff he says just really sticks with you. You know, he's very creative, but he also had a really great manner. I never met David Abbott, but I imagine he was similar in certain respects. He was a real gentleman, and clients loved him. And he had this thing with, when he first went in, was a bunch of work. He sat there, we've handed him all the scripts, and he never wanted you to read out. You just he just read them in his head, and he started making a pile next to his chair. And I was thinking, oh, this is good. We're going to have loads here, and this pile is getting bigger and bigger. And then, like the penultimate script, he put on another pile. So there's always two piles,
yeah,
if you're lucky. the one pile, like that was the thing he said, I quite like this one. and so the other, so whenever we went in after that, if there was only one pile made, you're never going to have nine scripts that Hegarty likes. So we always looked out for the pile, but it was a really, it's a very clever visual way of him showing you what's going on. And we always had great chats. He was really, he knew we were a bit bonkers and out there. And some of the stuff we did, like Murphy's Island, he had this idea about samurai warriors, and he said, "Yeah, it's great, just go for it," you know. And he was all for that. So it was great for us. But if you screwed up as well, and he had another lovely expression, which was like, if you gave him something he didn't like, he would just say, "I'm feeling a bit underwhelmed by this chap," and he'd leave, and he'd feel even worse that he'd said that, rather than if sorry, Keith or someone, and then later years, or Bruce going, "Boys, this is rubbish. There's nothing here." You know, he's quite, it would be quite brutal. But Hegarty is even worse because he just dropped you down. But I think we had a good time. I mean, I think we learned a hell of a lot. I think we worked with some major clients. But I think 6 years was a good run. And then we sort of left and went to a completely different set, which was Droga at Saatchi's. And that couldn't have been more different to BBH.
So, oddly enough, I had a chat with Dave Droga about 2 weeks ago about something completely different. We were talking about other things, but then it really, and also Duncan Marshall, and it really hit me how what an incredible force Saatchi's was at that time. And I think it'd be great if you could just give us a bit of an idea of what it was like being inside that place at that time.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was pretty phenomenal, you have to say. We were only there for 3 years, and I think for that, only Droga was only there for 18 months or 2 years, but you just knew it was, without sounding like a wanker, it was like you just knew you were in somewhere special, because he just had this sort of super charged, chaotic, mad way of doing shit. And I was trying to think of what was it about, and he just made shit happen. He just did stuff and made it happen, and he made it happen really quickly and effectively, and he didn't care whose feathers he ruffled or whatever. So, you know, the sort of thing he used to do was he'd come in our office, sit there, put his legs up, roll a little cigarette, run over to Julian Dyer, get a light, start puffing away and say, "Right, boys, what you got?" And what you got, as in, you know, so you know what you got. So we'd show him that and he'd go, "Okay, what else? What else you got?" And so we'd always be, Adam and I, very proactive. We're always kind of trying to do extra stuff. So, like, I don't know, maybe something on the army or 18 to 30. Okay, any more? And he would just bring it out of you. And then he'd go, "Right, give me that. I'll sell that." And he would just take something off you. And before you knew it was either sold. And, you know, and you're off and running. And you knew he just had this power. So, and he just did it. Everyone just went to sort of touch. You just walk into people and do it. And he sort of, it made you want to work for him even more, kind of, because he'd always see if you were struggling on something, he'd give you another chance or go, "What about this?" You know, or, I mean, for us, when we arrived, we did pretty well straight away. But then he said one day, I talked to someone last night about a sex shop they're launching, this Coco de Mer thing. "Do you want to go at that?" And we were like, "Yeah," you know. So he'd met Anita Ruddock's daughter, Sam Ruddock, who was launching this erotic. I got in these conversations with people. He was always out and about. He was, not only was he brilliant in the department, but then around London, he would be always out and about, you know, just chatting to people and at events and stuff. And he was kind of like a magnet. People loved him because he was just like fascinating Aussie, you know, like a little bundle of energy. And he would just roll up and down the corridor with this stuff and make things happen. And teams loved it because it was like, you knew if Droga got hold of something, it would be sold and be made and he'd be famous. And so on this thing with them, there's actually a team called Mike and Anna who are involved as well. And we both came to this, excuse the pun, we both came to this orgasms ideas quite quickly. And it was, I think there was a book at the time, or I was going to say the internet, I suppose it was in its infancy, but there was a well-known book that this photographer had done about people at the point of orgasm. And I remember seeing it in a bookshop thinking, "Fuck, we've got to use that for something. It's amazing." And then this, I said to Adam, "This is it, we've got to do this, you know." So that was great. But then the next bit was even weirder because we got Frank Budgeon to shoot them. So just rolling back a very quick beat, BBH, one of an FHM thing we wrote a TV spot for their calendar issue. And Frank was going to shoot it. It was going to be amazing. We got all the way till the day before the shoot, and then it was canned. And I can't tell you how broken we were. You know, that sort of,
yeah.
You know, never believe it till it's not on, until it's on air. And that was like, I mean, it was pretty close. We were the day before the shoot, and they had to write off Christ, a lot of money, like 60 to 100 grand. And Frank got all that. You know, they'd start casting and everything. But he did say, if you ever do a job again in the future and it's to do a photography, I'm up for it. I'm very keen photographer as well as a director. Okay. And so then when we got to this point, we said, well, why don't we give Frank a ring about this orgasms thing? And honestly, from there on in, it was like it sort of had a life of its own, because he said, this is it. This is what I want to do. And he you know, it was all, he just took over, him and Gorgeous, Tom Carty was involved a bit as well. And it just sort of had a sort of life of its own. And so we all went up to Sam, so the client's house was in North London. And we took it over for a week with people, I can't believe we actually did it now, where people would turn up, sit in the kitchen, and so you go, okay, mate, well, just give it 10 minutes or something like that. And that's what happened. People would go upstairs to the top of the house. No one was allowed into the top of the house apart from Frank and his lighting. And he just shot and shot and shot. And we didn't see anything. We just stayed downstairs, and we were kind of doing the kind of thing. I don't know what you call it. But kind of for a week it went on. And it's just amazing. Even looking back now, I think one of the most amazing things I've ever, you know, he was all over it again. What if they don't look good? You know, what if people look stupid, or what if you don't believe it? You know, and will they be having an orgasm or not? You know, so we said, right, backup plan. Let's get some porn stars as well, because they might be able to pull it off, which was really weird. So about half of the week, these people called Mercedes and Summer and things like that turned up. And they were literally walking around his kitchen just in G-strings and nothing else. And it was like, oh, God, I mean, yeah, it was sort of weird. And they were terrible. Frank, we go upstairs and they were literally just pulling faces. And you could tell, even us, like, you know, we looked at the contact sheets and you immediately looked at them and go, God, that's going to do it. But it was a backup thing. But then when we saw the actual shots that Frank had done, the real people. So Gorgeous had done an incredible car. Frank had got people he knew, and he got a mate of his, it was a bird watcher, and they were just this brilliant set of people, it was amazing. Frank kept going as well. Like, there was this joke that we ended up with 30 sort of characters who we used, and Frank was still going in like a hotel somewhere under. He got on his old girlfriends and was still going and saying, Frank, we don't need anymore. We got it. But yeah, it's great. I tell you what, even the account director at Saatchi did it. Sam Roddick did one as well. Adam and I were never asked, which I'm to this day slightly miffed about. But yeah, it was one of those. It's just that thing, like you're saying, he had this, and that was just one project, and it went amazingly well. You know, it got all over the papers and won awards and stuff. But he, Droger, just drove stuff, or gave you, you know, empowered you to drive for yourself, because you knew that once you got it, he would then PR the arse out of it. He would enter it to every ward. You know, he would just make stuff happen. And it didn't really matter quite how, you know. And I know, I think some people sort of asked a few questions of how he did things. But, you know, after a while you go, just go with it. You know, it's going to be brilliant. I mean, one of the best tricks I heard was he sort of pushed things right to the limit, to the time limit. And he knew an ad wasn't going to make it in time. So I think he sent an empty UMAP box to Cannes, and so when they get it, and then they open it delayed, then they have to ring up. It's brilliant. I think you bought him another week.
That's great.
Genius, isn't it? Sort of stuff,
yeah.
Like that.
Yeah.
I tell you the other thing he did actually, while we're on it, because we should just, he just wasn't, you know, you can see why he's so amazing now, but even then he every team he got going, like he had 18 to 30, Mike, he had multiple sclerosis with Colin T. Toyota, he had two or three teams. He had everyone going at once, because I think he knew like this 12-month period was going to be the moment to make his mark. And there was this NSPCC campaign called Cartoon,
yeah,
which I'm sure you remember. Actually, it was Frank again, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Who shot that? And, you know, and I'm going to get it wrong, so apologies if anyone's listening, I get it wrong. It's either Dave and Ed, Dave Hilliard and Ed Robinson, or Ajab. But they had written a campaign for NSPCC, and it was very good. And Drogon approved it and was kind of ruffling through. He kept sort of asking, you know, NSPCC was the big one at the time. He always, you know, that was renowned to be the big famous one. And Howard and Duncan, actually, funny you mention him, they had just drawn a squiggle in the corner of their pad, and it had it was a little cartoon of a kid being punched up, punched around. And they said to Drogo, oh, well, we've got this idea, which is, you know, real kids don't bounce back, and it was someone beating up a cartoon. And he went, that's it, we've got to do that. So they had to sell to NSPCC, to the director, to the creative team, and go, sorry, guys, this is better. And it was amazing. He did it. And I think that was possibly one of the most famous spots they ever did, you know.
Yeah. Can we just talk about your Toyota radio ad for a sec? Because it seemed to take on a big life of its own and was really good. I was just wondering, you know, because having written a bunch of radio ads myself, did one of you say, like, that line in the room, or how did, because the particular way it was said got picked up by a lot of people, and did you know that was going to happen?
Yeah. Well, what happened was, it was actually a very good brief, because they didn't want to show the Toyota, and because it looked a bit crap, and it had this one feature. It was all about the traffic. It gets you through the traffic quicker. So we just got the line, be careful, it might get you there early. So we actually had that, and we wrote a bunch of those ads. And Nick and Gav, Nick Stilinski and Gavin Kellett were brilliant, because they kind of, I think they actually wrote one of them and gave it to us. They were so sort of humble and kind. So we had a good sort of body of work and ideas, and we did some print with Malcolm Bemble. But that actual one ended up coming out of a bit of a joke. We used to do at BBH, and Hegarty's PA was a guy called Peter Wardle, who had a very distinctive voice. And when he picked the phone up, he would say, hello, John, from Hegarty's office. And I didn't really think this was funny, because he'd say the name, so it sounded like he was in office rather than a person. So I'd go into Sornby's office, another creative, and he'd say, go on, do your impersonation of Peter Wardle. So I started doing them. And Sornby was just looking at me laughing, going, go on, do another one. Do three on the run. Go on, beat it. Go on, do it. So I was doing the, hello, John Hegarty's office, like this. And I just kept doing them. And then I had this horrible feeling that Sornby had set me up, because behind me was Peter Wardle. And he was just looking at me, and I just died. I was, because Peter's a really sweet man. And he took it very well. But I was, anyway, so, it, you know, it kind of, you get it back, you bank it in your head. That's such a bad thing. But when we got this brief, we went, that's a brilliant thing, because that's sort of, if you got somewhere too early, you know, you could bust someone, you know, mocking you because you think he wouldn't be there. So we had this sort of semblance of a script. But then there's sort of a producer, a radio producer, and we went with him to Envy, I think. And we did, or maybe we didn't. Actually, no, I think we didn't do it at Envy, we did it somewhere else. But anyway, we got the League of Gentlemen to act it out for us. And that's where it went to another level, because they treated it like a little play. So they sort of made it not, you know, just made it like a kind of very normal scene. And then there's sort of lovely pauses where the guy comes in with a silly high-pitched voice. So again, it might have been like the Gail Porter thing. We sort of thought it was quite good, but you know, you never know, do you, when you're sort of doing that, it's going to be picked up or not. So we did it. And weirdly, of all the stuff we did, he went, yeah, it's okay, it's quite good. But Nick and Gav kept going, no, it's really funny, David, like really, really British humour and blah, blah, blah. And then that's where it kicked itself, because on the radio, people started really doing their impersonations of it to, God, I can't remember. It would be like Talk Sports. It must have been like London Radio or something, Capital, maybe. And people just rang up, and then they had a competition who could do the best version of it. And then I think we got a letter from the guy who runs the radio station saying, your has been more than the programming. And so, yeah, it sort of took on a life of its own, which was sort of strange, because, again, it was just like a little humble radio ad. And we ended up with a sort of DNAD nomination and all sorts of stuff. And I think it was a good idea, but I think the executioner, it was just phenomenal. The really tall guy, Mark, I think he is, from the League of Gentlemen, he came in with the voice. And when he did it, you knew, everyone just burst out. You know that thing, like, as soon as someone opened their mouth, it just, yeah, we all just, actually, the League of Gentlemen, the other two lads fell around as well. So it was a lot of fun. And I think, it was, actually, there was a bit of a kick in the nuts on that story, actually, because we did it as a 40, about it and everything. And then the cameraman said, oh no, we've only booked 30s. And by the way, you've got to put an audio mnemonic at the end. And so, oh God, bear my head, this nightmare. I had to recut it. And actually, again, it was probably the making of it because it ended up making it really, really tight. But it had this terrible mnemonic at the end, which was some naff 80s tune where they bought the four notes of it and we just couldn't understand it. So we had to persuade them. We said, look, we'll run it with and without and we promise you it's better without. But because they paid £4 million for these four, it was quite a funny experience.
And so, I guess that was a good bunch of really concentrated, good work happening there. So why did it come to an end and then why JWT afterwards?
It was always going to happen, the Droga thing. Like everyone said he's not going to stay. And I think he went maybe 2 years in, he went to Publicist New York. And we were like, oh, bloody hell. You know that thing when you've been signed by a football club and then another manager, like you're the guy who signed you, gets booed out or leaves. And then another guy comes in, you're suddenly quite nervous. You're thinking, am I part of the gang or not? So we were a bit twitchy. And a guy called Tony Granger came in.
Yeah.
And we got on really well with Tony. And I think we were quite smart in a way because we needed to up ourselves. We'd done a lot of just being a team and it was great fun writing the ads. But I think it was a moment where we had to go, right, we need to step up a little bit and start looking after the accounts a bit more. And he was very sweet. He made us CDs on Toyota and T-Mobile. I mean, very, very early door CDs, but we went along and met clients and stuff. And it was really good, actually. He taught us quite a lot about just keeping your mouth shut and listening to clients. And we did one spot with him for Toyota for the Key Party, which was a sort of from the Ice Storm, a sort of ripoff of the Key Party scene there. And that it was good, actually. But we definitely wanted to go. We'd had our moment with Droga and we thought, right, what's the next challenge? And so Nick Bell, who we'd known quite well and liked a lot and admired what he'd done at Leo Burnett's, had gone to JWT to do a kind of similar number there, you know, to sort of try and turn that around. And we had lunch with him and we definitely weren't going to go. And then Tom Carty had gone there as well, I think, to write with Nick on HSBC, and then Mike and Greg and Brittany and Jonathan Leiter, Mark Lawrence, a whole bunch of people we sort of knew and liked were all going. And we thought, you know what, we should do this. We should go for it. And Nick was brilliant. He was so persuasive over lunch. And we went for it. We thought, right, let's step up. Let's go work opposite Harris. And it was really weird, actually, because I always say this to Nick, regret saying it at the time, but I thought, I'd never thought I'd go to JWT and then probably have our probably most successful few years, because you kind of thought it's an unfashionable place at the time. It's one of those agencies that has spikes of great work and then down a bit and up, you know, rather than the BBHs and the Mothers and the Weedon Kennedys, you know, which are always producing. JWT was seen as a bit of an up and down, but you know, we thought we'd go in there and look after stuff. And Nick kind of got us in with his sort of whole set of new signings, and we just cracked on, and it was a really great time, actually. And I was sort of probably more surprised than anywhere I'd worked how much I enjoyed it. And he backed us on everything. That was the other thing, because he'd brought us in. His name wasn't above the door or anything, but he had a lot of power and he got a lot of work stuff through for us. And we were always, you know, if Nick was, it's a bit like Droga in a way, you know, if you knew that if Nick was behind something, invariably it was going to happen. So as long as we impressed him with our work, it was going to happen. And he was like that. He was a real force.
Yeah, and I guess that the most awarded thing you did there was the Golden Wonder stuff. So how did that come about?
The Skins, yeah, that was just like a, again, at BBH, you know, there were a lot of good clients there. You know, there were Smirnoff and Vodafone, Shell, HSBC, you know, big hairy global clients. But then lurking around in the sort of fringes was Golden Wonder, which was a real beaut. And we'd already had a go at it the internet had just, all this lookalike stuff was kicking in, and we'd had a whole campaign about crisps that looked like people, and, you know, there was like that razor bun thing, and we thought we were going to crack that. And we did so much, and for some reason the whole campaign died, and we were really gutted because we had Unit 9 in at the beginning, and they were just starting, and they were going to build us a website and a kind of a thing you could vote on your favorite lookalike crisp. And it was, anyway, the whole thing died, and we were like, bollocks, you know. And then Nick said, oh, there is this other brief flown around for these, there's new sort of crisps that they, they're just skins, golden skins. And we went, oh, okay, you know, and it's a kind of a, all right, we'll give it a go, you know. Again, just that kind of unwitting, oh, well, this actually looks quite good, you know. And then it wasn't kind of a, oh my God, here's the golden wonder brief that everyone won. It's a bit like, all right, we'll have a go at that. And then, of course, quite, you know, you don't, I mean, I don't know, you need to be a genius to do that sort of thing. We got there quite quick. We had two or three campaigns, and Nick just said, it's that one, you know. And we, it was all disarmingly simple, and people kept saying, but is there anything more, you know? So we go and see the client, go, no, all it is just a pale person eating golden skins, and there's no website, there's no headline, there must be no words on it. And Ty Ivey was brilliant, our typographer and sort of kind of person who helped. We just did loads of layouts of her, and we just kept selling it in. So we did it with a load of shots, actually, that Nadav Kander had done us to mock them up to show the client. And it was really weird. It was just like a glorified pack. We kept sending it to the client. It was just like a pack shot, you know, which it was in effect. I mean, the crisps were bang in the middle. It's like showing somebody drinking beer, you know. It's kind of a bit of a wet dream for a client, that. So we kept doing that bit and kind of not getting too big on the kind of like, we're going to have an albino and we're going to really, you know, we found this amazing photographer, William Selden, who to this day, I still don't know how he sort of does it, but he would do this thing in post where he just made people slightly otherworldly. There's any reason I can think of, or ethereal. He just had this quality, and I didn't know how he did it, but when we saw his stuff, we all thought, blimey, he's going to be really good. And so on the day of the shoot, we had a bunch of characters coming, you know, who we knew we were going to have to desaturate and sort of take a bit of the life out of the shots and post, but we also asked for albinos to come down, because that was something we're all really interested in because of the colour of the skin. And they ended up with like 30 albinos sort of queued up outside. And it was really weird, because we had to bring them, you know, all, we had to interview and shoot them. And you know, it was sort of one of those random things, like, what's going on here today? But we ended up with one girl who was amazing, and she was actually a bit of a fashion model time. So we had her, and then we had the other characters. And I think at the end, the client, at the last minute, kind of bottled it a bit and said, I think we should just have pack shots, you know. And we were like going, no, you can't do this. And it was like, oh, those horrible moments. You've got to keep going back. So we, I think he just got sick of the sight of me and Adam. And there was this account man called Will, a classic JWT account man. But he was actually very good. And we were on a mission. And Nick just kept saying, do not come back until you've sold it. And so we did it, and it was another really good experience. But I don't think we'd have been possible without Nick. William was incredible, and of course, I mean, ultimately the client got a lot of fame and fortune off it. But I think Golden Wonder themselves as a product were just a bit buggered, you know. I think Walkers were killing them, but it was a great fun job to work on.
Yeah, and from the outside, I mean, I guess that seemed like a bit of a golden period for JWT, and the work was great, and Nick's such a lovely guy and such a great champion of good work. But you went through a whole bunch of different, like, there was a huge time you didn't have a CD, as far as I could see from the outside. What was going on there?
Yeah. Well, after Nick went.
Yeah, I mean, after Nick went, it felt like it was a bit of limbo, I think, between Nick and Russell, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, by the end, Nick, I mean, it was gutting for us, because Nick was such a good job. Like, by the end, I think he got JWT London to second in the Gun Report, which is sort of pretty phenomenal. And I shouldn't say it, but I think probably that would be his high point, because, you know, it couldn't get much better than that.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, he had, there was a sort of, it was pretty foggy because I think Adam and I weren't in management land at all. We were still in just writing the ads. You know, we were meeting clients and stuff, but we didn't quite know what was going on. I think Nick and Craig Davis kind of had a bit of a set too. I had no idea what it was about or anything, but, you know, it ended and Nick had gone. And it was pretty pretty quick, pretty brutal. And we were all really, really upset with him. And it wasn't just us like there. I know, you know, people like Silburn and stuff. You know, Nick was done bad too there. But, you know, again, we were then sitting there going, well, what are we going to do? It's a bit like when Droga left Saatchi's, who's turning up? And it's that thing, you know, you're sitting in the JWT had this cafe called The Comma. You'd sit in there and you just wonder who's going to walk through the door next. And Russell Ramsey walked in like about a week later. And we'd known Russell really well and John O'Keefe at BBH. We knew them really well. So it was a kind of, all right, mate. He goes, yeah, I'm starting today. We were like, yeah. So it was kind of reassuring for us that, you know, Nick had gone and it was gutting. But then we going, right, well, what are we going to do? What are we going to do by ourselves? And, you know, you kind of sit there going, you know, are they going to hire a Brazilian guy? Are they going to be sort of some massive overhaul? Is it going to be someone from the back room, you know, the old football thing from the boot room? Or you just have no idea. So when Ross was there, first day, took us out for lunch, said, right, what's going on? And we gave him the lowdown and he said to us, right, you two have got to step up. I can see you're quite well paid. You need to start running accounts, doing big global pitches. And we were like, okay. So that was another sort of turning point for us where we definitely grew up even more. Like Nick had got us to a certain bit, but he had a couple more teams above us. But I think at this point, Russell said, right, that's it, you're doing it. And he moved our office from the long way down the corridor where we could sneak out down the fire escape and get home in good time or pop in late. And he put us right next to his and it was like a bastard. So, but in a way it's good because it made us grow up and like, you know, get with it. And he really made us part of the upper echelon. I mean, not the upper Uber up a bit. It wasn't kind of Bob Jeffrey land, but it was certainly, we felt part of London, Alison Burns, Guy Murphy, Toby to a certain degree, and himself, Joe Pettian. And we were like, then we were in, you know, we gave us Tourism Ireland to run. We ran the whole global Bailey's pitch and won it off of BBH, which was a bit of a coup, certainly for Russell, having just left BBH. And so that was brilliant. Suddenly going, right, we're really cooking now. And then we'd also worked for Axel Shouldercott on HSBC, who was at the other end of the corridor. And so it was actually a really nice mix of what you could have a bit. And Shell, we got involved in that. And you had the sort of more domestic stuff like Tourism Ireland. And, you know, your smaller things. I had a bit of thing on domestic violence we did. And, you know, you could have that lovely thing where you could do what I like calling big small. So you do a really big thing for HSBC or Shell, but then you do a little small thing like I was saying, for a domestic violence thing or for some little charity or a proactive piece. And there was always, you know, scope there for doing both. And Russell was a big advocate of doing all of that. And that was a really solid period for us to kind of work hard, get with that kind of senior creative director role. I know, and then you start looking up and thinking, you know, could I do Russell's job, you know, and blah, 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 or could I go on my own? And I think that's where I started looking a bit beyond it and started having those ideas. But I didn't really do anything about it for quite a while.
Well, yeah, I mean, you just touched on it a couple of minutes ago, but I think there's this point where if you are a very senior creative team or, you know, getting to be a CD team, that kind of stuff, there is a point where you do inevitably, unless you're very unusual, you split up and like you might have different career paths, you might have different things you want to go down, one of you might want to stay, one of you might want to go. So you've been working with Adam for a really long time at that stage. How did you handle the separation?
Yeah, it was ultimately it was fine actually. There wasn't any sort of pistols at dawn or anything like that. It was fairly amicable, but I'd sort of, I think about a year previous I'd actually gone for a job at Rainey Kelly along with the rest of London, I think, and I kind of thought, and then I did, and then, you know, in a way it was good it didn't happen then, because it just was bad timing. But then about a year later, because I'd sort of done that, whole process of going, right, I'm going to go on my own. And it was quite nerve-wracking because every interview you'd ever done has always been with your team, and it's two of you. So it's, you always feel so confident, and you're, you know, it was just felt so natural. So sitting on your own somewhere was like being unfaithful. It was just a shocker, you know. But once I'd done, it didn't happen, but once I'd done it, I started thinking, well, okay, that didn't work, but I definitely want to do it. Because I thought, I can't kind of not have had a go on my own. I really want, you know, that was one of my ambitions. I thought, if you don't have a go on your own, you never will. And so I talked to a few more people more often, and then suddenly, actually, weirdly, it was after I'd met you at JWT for a bit, when you were working with Adam Tucker, yeah, and we'd gotten really well. Mm. As you recall, that lunch we had in Zoom was quite fun.
It was fun. Yeah.
We'll leave that for another day.
Okay.
It's really interesting talking to you and Adam, and you know, you were both oneers at the time, but together. But you know, you sort of like, I really sort of opened my eyes a bit and thought, yeah, you know, go for it. And then I think Adam soon after went to Leo's, and then I think because I sort of knew Justin from award shows and stuff, and you know, we kind of got on, and you know, I went there, and it was a big move actually, you know, because like you said, after 18 years with someone, it's sort of it's the kind of easy thing that could have been to stay actually, because we were doing okay at J Dubs, and Russ liked us, and it was all right, but I kept thinking I want to sort of force myself to go on to something more, to get out of my comfort zone. So yeah, I mean, I think, but just before we left, ironically, you know, there's always that thing which we left. I left at such a good moment in a way, because we'd won the Army right at the end, and we'd just made. We were in the process of making two campaigns. One was called TA Live, where they were like live ads from a war zone, which was really, really hard to do, and I'd never done anything like it before. But we pulled it off, and that was one of those kind of fuck, how are we going to do this sort of conversation, which I love, and we did it in the end with Toby Clifton was a brilliant producer, and Jonathan and Anita were the team, and Adam and myself, you know, we made it happen, and that was pretty phenomenal actually. Hats off to JWT and the Army for doing that. And then we did the other spot, which was the boots spot with Simon Rattigan, which is all shot around the boots level, and that again was another really good piece. And it was really weird because I sort of had to leave as the sort of post-production was happening, and it was really galling that sort of leaving these babies, but Adam finished them off brilliantly and they were great. But it was a nice, in a slight selfish way, it was a nice way to go, rather than a kind of slipping out the back door, you know. It was better to go out the front head held high.
Yeah, so how did you find like, because having that position of more responsibility at Leo Burnett and being on your own, was that a comfortable experience, or was it like, okay, I'm getting out of my comfort zone? But because I kind of feel like you sort of.
It was fun. Listen.
No, go on.
Well, I was just actually listening to Ben Priest's podcast about when he left Brian, and he said it felt lonely, and it really resonated with me that, because I went into Leo's, yeah, come on, I'm going to do it, I'm on my own, I can do this. And I think it's one thing saying these things, but actually doing them is another. And Justin said that to me at lunch, you know, he's saying, look, be careful, because when you arrive, you will have that kind of aftershock. You will. Everyone has it when they've been in a team. And I thought, no, I won't. And of course, I did. And it nearly took me under. You know, I was really surprised, because I kept looking around the room, thinking, well, "Where's Adam?" You know, normally, like, just some of these questions, I just sort of don't deal with, or I'll start going on Twitter while someone else deals with this. And suddenly, going, "No, you're the person. By the way, you're running this account." Every bit of it, you know, you're coming to all the presentations, you're doing, running all the teams, you know, you're coming to briefing, you know, and it suddenly dawned on me, you know, it's a £50 million account. And it was me. And so, yeah, I think 6 months in, I was like, wow, bloody hell. But all the time I was getting with it. And then by about a year in, or a year and a half in, I think probably about, yeah, just after a year, I was like, wow, actually, this is great now, because I've done, you know, I know what's going on. And I started really, it sounds really thick, but, you know, I kind of understood the magic of three, like a suit, a planner, and a creative, running an account. But I'd never really experienced it pure, because at J-Dubs, I was always with Adam, and there was always quite large teams running stuff. Whereas actually, on the co-op, we had a really tight, the day-to-day was this guy called Sean, who was the suit, and Max was the planner, and me. And we would just regularly go out to Manchester on the dreaded 7:20 a.m. Tuesday morning to Manchester, and we would see clients all day, and then we'd come home. So you'd always work really late on a Monday night, which was a real fucker. But and then you had your week ahead. You know, you knew what you had to do. And Leo's was really organised. Justin ran a really tight ship, and it was incredibly efficient. And so actually, although it was a big old monster, and I was a bit lonely at times, it didn't feel after a while so bad, because I really respected having, you know, this team around me, not like creative teams, they were brilliant, but my team, you know, my suit and my pen. And I suddenly realized those are now your best friends, because they are the three, you are the three who are going to win or lose on this account. And so we had each other's backs, you know, the whole time. And it was a great feeling until still today. I sort of still see him and chat on about stuff. So that was a really, that had a very big impression on me. And so, yeah, and then, I mean, we had such a good bunch of teams as well. Justin had hired some great people. I mean, there was obviously Adam Tucker, who you know really well, but there was Matt and Pete, Phil and Darren, who I worked with at JWT and I love.
Yeah.
There was Richard and Gray, and the old BBH guys, really rock solid, great writers. There was a team called Blake and Will, who are quite interesting. They used to do like random stuff, but they won loads of awards. And it's just this great department, and they were, you know, you could just dip in and out of them. And at the beginning, I think Carp was not on their radar, a lot of people. You know, Macca's was. You know, there was Kellogg's, there was Home. Like Kellogg's, Homebase, Carp, and Macca's were the four massive accounts. And Macca's just topped everything. So I'd have to sort of shuffle into people's offices and, can you help me out in the co-op? And it wasn't easy at the beginning because it wasn't fashionable, you know. It's like Leicester. You know, you don't win the Premier League. But then what happened is, started getting a bit better and a bit better, and it started to have a momentum. And then after a while, I ended up getting the best teams on it. And then I got great directors. I ended up getting Vince Squibb in, and suddenly Vince wanted to do them all. So for a period of about a year and a half, Vince was doing everything and smashing them. And then by the end, we ended up with Tom Taghone, did our, well, my sort of last one, which was a Christmas one, and it was great. So he kind of, I got to understand the thing about the three. I got to understand about taking it slowly. Don't try and hit it out of the park every time, because there was a lot of work on the cart, which was just, you know, price driven or, you know, just get it out. And even then, though, we started going, actually, can't we help create new products and change the labeling? Like, we had this whole thing about putting recipes on labels instead of the labels. Instead of said milk, it would say macaroni cheese. So right. Milk would be the key ingredient of your macaroni cheese. Or instead of bacon, it would be called carbonara. So they started letting us do more and more. And then we got an initiative with local schools and trying to improve the way kids eat. And so it started again, you know, it's a bit like when I left JWT, actually. I got to this point where I started really enjoying what I was doing. And I had the backing of everyone. You know, Justin, he would really be fighting all the causes. You know, we would get to a certain level, but that cart was huge levels of clients, like way above me, and you'd have to have Justin involved, and you know, if people didn't buy the music, we could take it to high level. So it was very, very, very enjoyable running that from a difficult start.
Cool. And so how long were you there in the end?
I think it was 3 years in the end. And it wasn't all Carp. Justin was very smart as well. He created a culture where you could run your own account. A lot of people did. So Matt and Pete and Adam would run bits of McDonald's. You know, Guy would run, Tony and Guy would run Kellogg's. I would have co-op. But then you were all encouraged to do your own stuff, you know, your proactive bits, which were a kind of second nature for me. So I loved that bit as well. You know, if you had any juice left in the can at the end of the day, you were encouraged to do things like, so there was this thing called Business in the Community, who were looking after ex-offenders. And I did a campaign with Phil and Darren again and Adam Tucker on that, which was all about giving people a second chance. And you would have, if you did something there which was potentially, you know, award-worthy or PR-worthy or anything, you would get the backing not just of Justin, but, you know, Mark Tutsell over in Chicago would latch on to stuff, and they'd have this internal thing at Leo's called the eight ball. I don't know if you know about that, where if they would look at all the work around the Leo's network, and they would mark certain pieces of work with an eight ball, and then your work was marked to be sent to Cannes, and it was really like they would look at your film and everything. And it was brilliant in a way, because you knew if you got to that level, you would always have a chance. So we did that again on Amnesty. We did a thing. It was Adam again and Blake and Will for competition with JC DeCoe. And again, that kind of got the eight balls. And once you got that, your work was marked to be ramped up. So they were very shrewd at Leo's. I felt like they did the day-to-day running really, really well. But then they had this huge kind of other work stream, getting the work good for awards. So I think it was – I was probably almost my most enjoyable periods there and productive. But again, like by the end, I'd kind of had enough. I didn't want to be – you know that thing, Ben, when they go, oh, yeah, he's the supermarket guy. You know, yeah. Oh, he's the guy who does cars. And I desperately didn't want to be there. I wanted to move on again. So I ended up returning, actually, to Saatchi's.
And so it must have been a very different Saatchi's, I guess, at that point.
Yeah, it was. This might be nearly the end of the podcast now, Ben. I wanted a change, and Co-op and Leo's were brilliant. It was very domestic, very UK-based, fast turnaround, like, you know, seat of the pants at times. Like, sometimes you'd be getting a radio brief in the morning, and I couldn't, you know, they wanted it by the afternoon. And we would be in at Grand Central and Bishop Bank, which I kind of got sort of hit off that. I kind of used to love it. But also, it was like, right, I need to kind of maybe look at something else. And the opportunity came to Speci globally back at Saatchi's, and I thought, well, that'd be quite good, because I had all that experience at JWT, and I knew the client, and I'd gone really well with Kate, and Saatchi's, you know, the DNA is amazing. So on paper, it was brilliant. You know, it's a bit like the England team, isn't it? You look at it and you think, God, this should be better than we are. And I don't know. It was awkward, actually. It didn't quite work out. But I was in a little bit of a bubble, the HSBC bubble, and I couldn't. So I was sort of working a bit to Kay, a bit to Potsy and Jexy, but kind of on your own, which was fine. But then it was just so awkward, because you had so many different regions, you know, Hong Kong and France and America and all that sort of meant to be funneling into me. But it was quite challenging, because a lot of local markets just wanted to stay local. And I think the landscape had changed. So in the intervening period from when I was at JWT, I thought it would just be like bobbing back into that again. And clearly, you know, things had changed in the world, and less money, there was less opportunity. And I think on paper, it seemed a good idea. And I think, you know, I had very high ambitions for it. And I think the client kind of did as well. But then the reality of it kind of sets in and going, no, you can't do that idea in an airport. We need to do this thing, and, you know, stop fiddling around on Twitter. Let's, you know, and there, quite a few turns, I thought, can't blind me. It's definitely harder than it should be. But right at the end, I had a nice sort of little run with Marie Curie. Jexy and I did a couple of nice things on that, and it kind of restored my faith a bit. And it was actually, it's just one of those things, it just happened and we move on. So I left, I think after about a year.
Yeah, and so now you was that when you went to VCCP, or was there other stuff in between?
I had a sort of few months just on my own, having a nice little break, and I think I did a few things. I actually start again meditating, which was quite fun, and I went on, just did loads of things I wanted to do, like see parts of London I never seen, did some writing, hung out with my kids, and then got an opportunity in the January to go to VCP on a kind of short-term contract and see where it went. And so I had, well, I've just finished that now. So it was about over 8 months. And it was great, actually. I really enjoyed it. Again, it was another very different place to all the other places I've been at. So it was a really good experience, because they're not independent, but they kind of are. They're not like one of the, they're not owned by one of the big groups. And they felt quite nimble, although there was like 700 people there or something. It felt quite kind of, not startup-y, but they had this sort of lightness of touch in a way. And it's a very sort of buzzy agencies, open plan, there's loads going on. And the main thing is this, the new business thing. It's just incredible. And I thought, I'd always looked in from other agencies and thought, God, I wonder how do they get on every list, you know, all the time, you know. They were always killing other agencies. And so I was always intrigued by it. And I knew Jim Thornton pretty well. And Jim was the one who said, well, why don't you come over and have a look? And I chatted to him. I met Daz. And then I met Matt Lever as well, who was great. And I kind of, I thought, this should be great, you know. So I got in thinking, you know, I'm going to give this a go. And then I was just sort of settling in. And like literally on the second day, they said, right, you've got to get on a train tomorrow to Brussels to pitch for Suzuki. And I was like, okay, right, yeah, great, great, great. So I got on a train and I didn't actually know anybody's name of the pitch team I was on. So it's kind of surreal, but I said, oh, I'm Hugh, your name is, blah, blah. And then before we knew it, we were in the room. And I was calling the head of planning, David, for like the entire week, and his name was Andrew. And it was just like, it's just sort of summarize, you know, how mad and quick and, you know, just intense it was, but everyone is together, and that's how it rolls. And so we did that, and that went incredibly well. We won it, and we made it. We shot it with Kevin Thomas not long after, and then they put me straight onto eBay, which was an even bigger pitch. So I did that, and we won that. I did that with sort of Daz a bit more, and we sort of went all over Europe and the whole world there, and that was phenomenal. And like I was saying at the time, I just started meditating, and I had this mantra, which you're not allowed to tell anyone. So that used to sort of bob around my head when I was meditating. But then I had so many end lines going around my head as well that they started creeping into my mantra. So I had this fairly surreal morning one time. I was looking out across San Francisco, trying to calm myself down with this mantra, and then these bloody end lines keep coming in. So that was great, and that was a big old number, and we had to meet all the American clients, which subsequently actually they ended up running their work and not our work, so it's a bit of a shame. But by far my toughest moment, I think, at VCB and probably my career, was pitching for Manchester City, being a Man United fan, and that was a cruel trick from Dougie, a mate of mine, Julian Douglas from BBH days, and he's a massive City fan. I'm a big United fan, and so we always have this sort of banter. And then he said, come on, Toddy, you're pitching for City with me. And he already had something going with him, but he started making me the creative director. And, God, he made me actually read out a manifesto which had to say something like, and we took the dirty red 6-2 in their backyard or something. I had to say it was awful, Ben, and I was trying to keep it professional. He said, you cannot say, Toddy, don't say you're a United fan. So I kept my... I kept my wits about me, but yeah, that was fun. So we got to meet those guys, and you know, they have got a lot of money, Man City. They make United look a bit poor. So I think overall that was a brilliant experience for me. It was kind of, and I suppose now coming around to what we're up to now, I'm purposely not trying to go back in yet. I want to have a little think and a little bit of a lie down. But I kind of quite enjoyed that experience of going in somewhere, intense pitching, looking after stuff, and then bobbing out and going in. And I think that is becoming a trend as well now for creative directors, you know, of a certain ilk. And I kind of think that might be where it lies for me. But then also I've started doing some journalism. So I'm writing for Creative Review now. Just doing a couple of pieces, and then I'm also doing some of all my local shops around here in Highbury, because they're all been threatened by Sainsbury's and Tesco's and stuff. So I'm trying to get a little cooperative, and I'm going to make an exhibition and a book of all the guys and sort of big them up and stuff. I did it about a year ago on my blog and Instagram, and I didn't do enough. I basically ended up starting work at BCP before I could get going. So this time I thought, right, use your time, and I might actually try and make that happen. And of course, I'm trying to swim the channel. I don't know if you spotted.
I did see that you were kind of swimming the channel.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, so it's in little slugs. So yeah, that's what's kind of keeping me busy.
Cool. Well, I guess that's up to date now, then, really. So
yeah, I think so.
interesting place, some interesting work. And I guess, you know, you and I must have started not that different times to each other. So it's interesting to see how a very different journey has sort of gone on in the same years of advertising. But
yeah, because you know what? I mean, without blowing smoke at your ass, but I actually sometimes look at you and think, God, it's really, we've gone on very different paths. And it was great, by the way, you hosting us when we came to LA. That was very kind of you.
Yeah.
So but if you ever come back, come here to Arsenal and I'll show you what the local team are like. Not very good. I mean, I don't quite have as much energy as you, but I kind of like what you're doing because, you know, you've done a lot of agent experience and then you've written a novel and you do lots of interesting things. And it's that thing Hegarty sort of used to say, you know, here you go, quoting Hegarty again, but if you do interesting things happen to you. And it's that kind of, you have to remain relevant, don't you? And keep pushing and seeing where you get a pull in the universe. And that's, you know, when I sort of seen what you've been doing, and even with the blogs, my blog is pretty lame. But again, I started just thinking, well, that's another way of, you know, of expressing itself. And I've really enjoyed, just doing more stuff like that. So, thank you for that.
Well, cool. And send me your work and I'll also put links up to what you're doing now and your blogs and stuff like that. And people can just check it out and find out how to get in touch if they want to do that.
Brilliant.
So huge thanks, Hugh. And,
thank you, mate.
I'll stick this up in a couple of weeks, I guess.
Yeah. Brilliant, Ben. Thank you so much. Really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Cheers, Hugh. Huge pleasure. Thanks.
Take care, Ben.
Okay, bye. You too. Bye. Bye.
Podcast to watch Christmas.